Welcome to the Jack Straw Writers Program, a series of live readings and conversations with Pacific Northwest writers, recorded during the spring of 2005 at Jack Straw Productions in Seattle. This year's series was curated and hosted by John Mifsud. In this program, we will hear from poet Susan Rich and writer Maliha Masood. Here's your host, John Mifsud.
Our next reader is Maliha Masood. She's a writer, traveler, and activist. She frequently writes essays and commentaries on Islam, gender, and culture. Tonight, she'll be reading from her forthcoming travelogue, In the Middle of the East, a Muslim-American woman's odyssey from Cairo to Istanbul. Please help me welcome Maliha Masood.
Thank you all for coming tonight. I call this one Peekaboo. To travel in the Middle East is to confront the staring mafia. A curious and friendly lot, these men, women, and children don't mean any harm. They're just curious and intrigued at the sight of the ajnabi or foreigner whose peculiar habits provide ample training ground for professionally certified stares. Even though I still wore my headscarf, I couldn't blend in Amman the way I had in Cairo. Perhaps it was my slow-measured walk and wandering eyes taking in my new surroundings that gave me away. I changed tactics by trotting on the streets of downtown Amman like those no-nonsense executives blasting their way through midtown Manhattan. Some days, I even pretended to know where I was going, to the point of losing all my bearings in the labyrinth of back streets. No one else around me walks so fast. Jordanians preferred a centipede crawl. Women often linked arms with each other, and men held hands with a childlike affection rarely encountered in the West. They would pause in front of shop window displays of Nike and Adidas, heads tilted to one side and ears glued to cell phones as the idiot foreigner swirled by like a hurricane. So whenever my American girlfriends grow knowingly about the hassles of traveling in the Arab world, even though they have yet to experience it for real, I tell them, well, yes, but think of some of the advantages. Instead of being a nobody back home, a woman can feel like a Hollywood celebrity for a day by strolling around the streets of downtown Amman. From the moment Bea and I stepped foot outside our hotel, we were made to feel like Greta Garbos in disguise. For starters, the men's eyeballs were nailed to our faces. They would audaciously walk ahead of us and turn around to steal another glance, teetering backwards like a pack of drunken sailors. One day, Bea and I tried a little experiment. We walked out with our heads uncovered, but this produced no difference. At that time, I resented their gawking, but the reverse cultural shock of public anonymity in American streets caused me to yearn for our attentive fans in Amman. Despite the annoyance factor, the men had made us feel alive simply by acknowledging our existence in the world. Now that I am no longer a part of that world, I miss the heightened curiosity towards strangers that was once so bothersome. It was simply another way of saying, yes, you are here, and your presence matters. Amman was polished and sedated. As an Arab capital, it lacked the drama and exuberance of my beloved Cairo. I berated myself for having left so soon. Movement was foremost on my mind. The act of physically moving or displacing myself through time and space was key to new discoveries. But could it be that there are two kinds of movements, one having to do with motion and the other with stillness? Perhaps if I had remained still in Cairo, I would have moved more. The old Roman amphitheater was our favorite afternoon hangout. Tourists drifted in and out, climbing around the perimeter and shouting at each other in a linguistic stew of German, Japanese, Spanish, French, Italian, and American slang. The old security guard welcomed Bea and I on our frequent trips to the theater like a estranged family. Ahlan wa sahlan! Ahlan wa sahlan! Offerings of tea, biscuits, and oranges appeared from his small caretaker's cottage near the gated entrance. He warned us to keep away from teenage hustlers and freelance tour guides parading around the theater. I had seen them in their leather jackets and gel-slicked hair. They didn't seem inclined to wage jihad against America, so much as being consumed by its mystique. A cute Jordanian girl approached us. She shoved a camera into my hand and asked me to photograph her group of friends. I got into the act and ran up and down the steep stairs as if doing a photo shoot for an Arabic version of Vogue. The girls needed no encouragement in showing off their poses in front of the gathering male audience. One of them crossed her leg, allowing the slit in her ankle and skirt to reveal a shapely calf with fashionable tights and a herringbone pattern. Her eyes spoke without words. Her curvaceous smile seemed more alluring than a dozen bare-backed models sashaying down a New York catwalk. I was about to snap the shutter when the smiling girl stood up and made her way down the stairs. "Hey there. Thanks for the pics. My friend Nadia, she's nuts about photography. She won't leave the house without her precious Minolta." She reached into her skirt pocket and took out a chapstick, uncapped it, and rolled it on her lips. "So, what are you guys doing here? Are you teachers or something? I kind of thought you might be folks from one of the embassies. But you don't look that tight. You guys seem way too mellow." I gasped, stared, and gasped again. B gripped my eyes in surprise. We remained speechless. Her name was Layla. She was transplanted to Jordan when her parents moved back. Before that, she had lived in L.A. for 10 years and went to an American high school. Layla played on the girls' soccer team and drove down to Baja on weekends. She missed watching Oprah. "It must be a big change for you to live here," B recovered. "Yeah, it was pretty scary at first. I mean, I couldn't go out by myself anymore. I had to be chaperoned by my cousins and aunties. We live up in the hills, which is not that different from the States. Well, it's not quite the same, but I could handle it okay. Then I really wanted to go back to L.A. to see my friends again, but my dad wouldn't let me go. He wanted me to stay here and learn about the culture and all that crap." "He refused to pay for my plane ticket and even took away my passport. I was pretty pissed. We fought about it all the time. He started freaking out every time I watched Friends. He didn't want me to be contaminated by American culture anymore, so he got real strict. Not like back in L.A. He was real cool there. I got away with tons of stuff. But here I can't do much. It's been 2 years now, and I got no place to go." Layla winced and smiled at the same time. She sat down on the stone stairs next to B and I and tucked her leg sideways. "Well, Jordan is not so bad. I mean, surely you can have fun here and not feel so restricted," B said. "Look at us. We are traveling around by ourselves, and so far so good." "Yeah, but it's different for you guys. You don't live here. You're not Arab, so you're not accountable in the same way that I am. You guys are considered foreigners. You can skip the rules that we can't. It's not the same." "Oh, yeah?" I jumped in. "If we have so much freedom, then why do we feel obliged to wear this?" I tugged at my headscarf. "Not all foreigners are the same out here. If we had blonde hair, we could get away with murder. But we get more hassled, and they know there's nothing they can do about it. You're different being Jordanian. You must have family connections and all sorts of immunity." Layla sighed. "Yeah, I guess you have a point. I mean, I don't really think about my outfits. I wear what I like and nobody says anything. I didn't realize that you guys would have to cover up to blend in. But let me tell you something." She leaned her face closer to ours. "The girls here are not as goody-goody as they look." "What do you mean?" I asked. Layla giggled like a naughty little girl. "I've started my own business. It's an online dating service. I designed the website myself. Now I just have to get people to sign up. But my cousins are afraid. They don't want to end up with some goon who looks like Freddy Krueger." "Wow, that's a fantastic idea. Do you really think it will take off?" B was enthusiastic. "Sure it will. I'm not doing anything wrong. It's just a way for guys and girls to meet and check each other out. How else will we ever get married?" I told Layla about the marriage ads in Indian and Pakistani cultures, full-fledged proposals emphasizing degrees and skin colors. Layla laughed. She tore a piece of notebook paper and scrawled her email address. The only difference is, here they do everything behind closed doors. That's what I can't stand. The sneaking around, the lying, the deception. It's so much cleaner back in the States. So much more out in the open. People have trouble accepting change here. But I'm gonna stir things up. Thank you very much.
Maliha Masood reading as part of the Jack Straw Writers Program. Our program continues with Susan Rich. Once again, John Mifsud.
Our last reader this evening is Susan Rich. Her writing reflects her work with Amnesty International, the U.S. Peace Corps, as well as human rights work in both Bosnia and Palestine. Ms. Rich's recent awards include an Artist Trust Fellowship from Washington State and a Fulbright Fellowship to South Africa. It is both a pleasure and an honor to introduce Susan Rich. Please help me welcome her.
Thank you, everybody, for coming out. I'm reading tonight poems from my project, Somali Voices in Poetry, which was born just about a year ago. I thought, how can I bring my love of poetry and match it with my love of human rights work? And I could interview people from Somalia about what Somalia was like, about their experiences during the Civil War, and about coming to the United States. The first poem that I'll read is called We Talk of What You'll Do When You Return. And there's two things, I think, that you might like to know. One is that there's a tree called a camphora tree, which is where myrrh comes from. And the other thing is that there's a reference to something called the counting of names, which is the closest to what we have of a family tree. And the difference is that you'd be able to recite it by heart. We talk of what you'll do when you return, from Mahmoud. Invite in the warlords. Text message the deadly youth of Mogadishu. Tell the women hand-washing linen. Quranic students chanting under the camphora tree, to cancel all negotiation, abandon gifts from global relief. In the dream of return, coaching family rhythms into leagues of athletic rivalry, you'll pump up each clan, each sub-clan, to compete, compete, compete. Not over wells to poison, nor uncles, cousins, children, dead in the fields, dead along the open sewered streets. Instead, you'll imagine a world, a ribbon of Olympic torchlight, relighting Somali legend, with no angst, no anxiety. In the counting of names, which tribe will claim the most doctors, teachers, road builders, which family the Nobel laureate, the poster child PhD. In Kismayo, the young girl fills test tubes, invests in her own depths of discovery. The young boy draws his life from the sweet liquid of drain pipes, rainwater cultivating your landscape, each acre breathing along an open coastal sea. This next poem is Ishka's story, and something that's probably useful to know as you listen to it is that there's two voices. There's the voice of the narrator, and then there's the actual accounting from an interview with a person telling her story. And it takes place in Washington at Fort Worden in Port Townsend. There's some references to it. Ishka's story. From here, the world seems random. Waves resurfacing and waving again. Tank-bellied clouds, ducks' beaks, a guiltless sky. Days beget days, and I try to shape an alphabet alarm across one simple page. Ishka says, you can never really write what happened anyway. It's like a hole that fills constantly with water. No rooting system on this sun-drenched beach. no cosmic tide reordering, nothing bright in what I have to say. If war is a kind of handmade quilt, her needles pierce torn portions of our lives. Iska repeats her story unembellished. No flowers, no forgetting in our four-hour interview. Across from my cabin, the worn, weathered box of an old man's mobile home. He's planted rows of plaid armchairs. One guy was just going, throwing grenades constantly at that hour. So whenever anybody had to do chores, they had to do them before 5 p.m. and then just go inside the house and pray to God, wait and see when you were going to be hit. Why not write another kind of Somali story? Iska slipping into Hollywood movies, the pre-war cafes, French schools, fabric mills, late afternoons walking an angel-ringed promenade by the beach. Children return home to dinner as anxious mothers lick their sons' elbows, a taste test to see if the boys were diving in the sea. This person got cut off both his legs. This person lost an arm. This person lost a daughter. This lady, she was cut into little, little pieces, and they couldn't find her body. So they put the pieces together, and the pieces came to just this much. So perhaps wounds and words don't work together. Why try and reclaim unimaginable pain? Everything happens for a reason, Iska repeats. It's her ballast, her well-worn chorus line. And when it's your time, it's your time. Can you imagine? One religion, one culture. We talk the same language, but we cannot understand each other. God took the blessing out of the language. One minute you're chopping sweet potatoes for dinner, a late sunlit afternoon. The next, the world explodes, and the porch upon which you're laughing no longer exists. A dozen cousins disappear in a crush of chemical air, leaving you blinded and alone. Or not alone. You're climbing up a wall. Does someone in white lift you up, alter your direction, so that now you climb out of the rubble, out into the street? You are blood-covered, shrapnel wedged in like stick pins in your shoulder. But you're fine. And then there's no one there to thank. No one wearing white. No angels here. Another frayed end, and I'm here again, by a cabin in Fort Worden, former home to military washerwomen. And now the fort complex becomes fodder for artists. One dance director oozes over the old abandoned bunkers. Iska watches as she marches her company out at midnight to dance barefoot on cement stages. No, no angels here. Muhammad at the mosque for my student upon his graduation. And sometime later, in the lingering blaze of summer, in the first days after September 11th, you phone. If I don't tell anyone my name, I'll pass for an African-American. And suddenly, this seems a sensible solution. The best protection to be a black man born in America, more invisible than Somali Muslim asylum seeker. Others stayed away that first Friday, but your uncle insisted that you pray. How fortunes change so swiftly I hear you say. And as you parallel park across from the Tukwila Mosque, a young woman cries out, her fears unfurling beside your battered car. Go back where you came from. You stand, both of you, dazzling there in the midday light, her pavement facing off along your parking strip. You tell me she's only trying to protect her lawn, her trees, her untended heart, already alarmed by its directive. And when the neighborhood policeman appears, asks you, asks her, asks all the others, so what seems to be the problem? He actually expects an answer, as if any of us could name it, as if perhaps your prayers, chanted as this cop stands guard, watching over your windshield during the entire service, might hold back the world we did not want to know.
Susan Rich, reading as part of the Jack Straw Writers Program. These readings and interviews were recorded at Jack Straw Productions during the spring of 2005 as part of the Jack Straw Writers Program and co-produced for radio with KUOW-FM. The curator of this year's program was John Mifsud. Audio engineer and producer for radio was Scott Bartlett. The program's manager was Steve Peters. The executive director of Jack Straw Productions is Joan Rabinowitz. The Jack Straw Writers Program is made possible with support from the Paul G. Allen Family Foundation for the Arts, the Brenneman Jake Foundation, Arts Fund, the Mayor's Office of Arts and Cultural Affairs, the 4Culture King County Lodging Tax Fund, the Washington State Arts Commission, the National Endowment for the Arts, Humanities Washington, and individual contributors. Support for radio production provided by Clark Neuber, Certified Public Accountants and Consultants. Original music provided by Jack Straw Artist-in-Residence, Ela Lamlin. All of the writers heard in this series are published in Volume 9 of the Jack Straw Writers Anthology and featured online in the Jack Straw Writers Forum at jackstraw.org. To purchase a copy of the anthology or for more information about Jack Straw Productions or the Jack Straw Writers Program, please contact us by phone at 206-634-0919. Or visit us at www.jackstraw.org. Thanks for listening.